2. All right, welcome everybody. This is the 5th lecture of the 1500s, and it's the night is 12/23/2017. Okay, we're continuing with the 1500s. We mentioned what really got the this century going was the expulsion from Spain. And that really turned the entire Jewish world on its head. I mean, for sure, for anybody, for Spanish Jewry, but all the places that Spanish Jews were exiled to, they also had to absorb them. So we're going to see. So where did they end up going? We mentioned they went to Portugal. That didn't last for too long. After 5 years, they were kicked out of Portugal again. Actually, they were kicked out, but they weren't allowed to leave. Go figure. Actually, they were forcibly converted, but sometime afterwards, they were allowed to leave, and then from that point on, slowly but surely, they started to leave. What was happening? Where did the other Jews go? Many went to North Africa. And in North African cities, some places were better at absorbing the Jews than others. But the best place, if the Jews, those Jews that made it to the Turkish Empire, those were the Jews that were the most fortunate. I mean, when I say most fortunate, it's, you know, they left on the most harrowing experiences, thrown out on their heads, thrown into boats with people that were just more interested in their money. And they were lucky if they just weren't thrown on some island or just left to sea. But those, finally, when they made it there, they were accepted. I know we did this a little bit last time we started with the background of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. But since the Ottoman Empire is now going to be the main empire that the Jews are going to, Sephardic Jews especially, are going to be part of. So I just figured let's do a little bit of a history of the Ottoman Empire. And among the conquests of the Ottoman Empire is going to be a small little country, or at least it was a region in that area called Israel, or back then I think it was called Judah. But the cities of Jerusalem, Safed, or Sfat, these are all going to be part of the Ottoman Empire. So just also, this empire, by the time the Jews were let out, by the time that the Jews were sent in exile in 1492, this empire was 200 years in the making. 200 years in the making. So we know from the Gemara Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, when it comes to the Jewish people, Hashem is a certain hanhaga, and that is Hashem creates the refuah before the machla. And an example of this would be the Turkish Empire. The Turkish Empire was before Hashem exiled the Jews from Spain. He gave them a place that would welcome them and allow the Jews to actually thrive. And the Jews will thrive, both economically and spiritually. There's going to be a renaissance in terms of learning, in terms of all types of learning, in terms of halacha, something which breakthroughs that never happened before, Kabbalah. General learning is going to be just a tremendous renaissance, and it's going to be possible by a country like the Ottoman Empire. And Hashem prepared it. Hashem took 200 years starting. Well, I guess we could really start from the very, very beginning. I know I mentioned this last time. 632, Muhammad dies. And then from there, he mainly went, while Muhammad and was the founder of the Islam religion, while he was alive, they mainly stayed in the Arabian Peninsula. But after his death, the caliphates, the leaders of the Muslim world, they went public, I guess, so to speak. They expanded, and by the time within 100 years, they conquered most of the world. As you can see over here, this is the Arabian Peninsula. they started like over here, Medina, Mecca, and by the time that they were done, they walked all. They were all the way towards India to the east, and they were all the way through Spain to the west, all the way up to the gates of Vienna. So they conquered everything except for Europe, and that was. And then since that time, that was their largest advance. And since that time, the Christian world was slowly ebbing away, and just taking back from the Muslim Empire.
The Jews who lived in Northern Europe, what happened to them when the Jews were exiled out of Spain? Did they have to go also?
Well, we're going to, I guess, after when we finish with the Spanish exile, we'll go back to the European situation. But in Western Europe, there were really no more Jews. They were exiled in the 1100s, 1200s, 1300s.
They never came back to...
Not in mass. Not like it. Never. The focus of Jewish life kept moving east. And we're going to see by the time that this happened also, the focus was, the main Jewish life was in Poland. It's very similar things was happening in Europe as it was in here, but Poland became the new, the in place, and people were migrating as they kept getting kicked out of places, let's say in Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, at the time it was called, they kept moving east to Poland. So we're going to get back to that. But you're right, at that time, Poland was becoming the center of Jewish learning for the Ashkenazim, and not to say that there weren't Sfarim that made its way into Europe, but the Ashkenazim, the Sfarim, were moving also east into the Ottoman Empire.
What happened to the Sephardim that went to Amsterdam? And
so we're going to talk about that. They came a little later, and those were more... The Sephardim that went to Amsterdam, that was like in the late 1500s, early 1600s.
Oh, okay.
So those were real... anusim, I don't want to use the term Maranas, anusim, conversos. They were conversos for many years, and they started a... it was a different type of Sephardim than the Sephardim that left right away, or left as soon as they can. They were like conversos that started coming back, as opposed to always Jews, or, you know, forcibly converted Jews that just went back to becoming Jews, and not that went back, but it was always Jews, and just went to the Ottoman Empire Muslims that they could practice Jews. So we're really now talking about those that ended up leaving Spain and if in Portugal, leaving shortly after they could in Portugal, pretty much right away, and they're making their way all along the Mediterranean into different areas, North Africa, okay? Just what shook things up, what shook things up in the world as well, was in the 1200s, the Mongols. They came from China all the way across, and they also threatened Europe, but they threatened Europe from the east. And they made their way, even into Poland, Russia for sure, at one point was under the Muslims. So, and because of the Muslims' invasions, a lot of countries were displaced. A lot of clans, a lot of different clans of people, tribes, if you will, families were displaced. One of the families were this family of Turks. Now, the Turks were a larger set of people. Ottomans, well, they were like a little bit of a... You had... the Ottomans were one family clan. They took the name, we'll see. But you had Seljuk Turks and all different types of Turks. As a matter of fact, the Seljuk Turks, they were the empire before the Ottomans came. They were the Muslims that were there. They were the reason of they were the cause, really, for the Crusades, the Seljuk Turks. So Turks is a name of a people, and then in the name of the people, you had different clans, one Seljuk and different clans. Seljuk, when they started getting power, they started blocking the way for Christian pilgrims going to Jerusalem. And that was in the 1096, that was what really started, got the First Crusade going. So that those were the Seljuks. Now, what happened is, it was this one family, and the one that moved and started, the Seljuk Turks gave a piece of real estate, a piece of land, to Ertugrul, I don't know how to say his name. Huh? Okay, Ertugrul. They gave him a piece of land, and that was his, like, you know, he was also Turkish background. And they gave him a little area, an area. Now, you know, and he was, they were really more east, but they came west into where the Seljuks were because of the Mongols. So you see, everything moves, everything else. So then what happened is, okay, and this is what the Mongol Empire looked like. Mongol Empire was the largest land empire in the world, larger than any other empire in terms of land. And this is what it looked like, you know. It had all the way from the Pacific, all the way into Poland, up to Hungary, all the way down. It never got Israel or Egypt, but it. The area that we're going to be looking at, this is called Asia Minor. Asia Minor, that's where everything is going to start. It's the south is the Mediterranean Sea, to the west of it is the Aegean Sea, and the top of it is the Black Sea. So it's really connected on all three sides. And the other side is Europe. And that's, you know, that's Asia Minor. That's what we would call Asia Minor. And the other side is Europe. So that's where the Ottoman Empire is going to start. So they started somewhere more west, and they ended up in Asia Minor. Turgul had a son, Osman. Now, the Ottoman Empire, that's who it's named after. I guess Osman was the first, and he was some sort of a conqueror. And, you know, he started conquering certain lands from other people, and he started becoming bigger and bigger. And this was in 1299. So in 1300, this is the Ottoman Empire is named after Osman. They were sons, direct son after son after son. I think that ended in the 1800s. It was son after son after son of the Osmans. He started the empire. It was named after him. One of the largest, one of the longest lasting empires from the 1300s till the 18th. Even today, Turkey, but now Turkey is not the same. It is the heir of the Ottoman Empire. It fell apart in the World War I. They think losing the war, it picked a loser. Ottomans came in on the Central Powers, picked Germany and Hungary, and lost. And so that was it. It was totally dismantled by the British and the French. So up to the 1900s, 13, that's about 600 years. It's a real long, long empire. Number one was Osman, 1299, 1326. We'll just go through. But originally, they were just in Asia Minor, which is over here. They just had that little black area over there. That's where it all started. And then they just kept conquering. The next thing they conquered was what you see red, and then what you see yellow, and then comes the purple. One of the first conquered areas that was conquered by Osman was an area called Bursa. It was probably the first Jewish community that came under the empire. This early, again, in the early 1300s. It was expanding at the expense of the Byzantines. Byzantines was Christian. Right, and this is the same Byzantine Empire from the Romans, right? The Romans, way, way, way back, the Roman Empire in the 300s, 350s, they split into two. It was too big. It couldn't manage it from one area. So the Constantine split the government into two. One became the Western Roman Empire, and the other became the Byzantine Empire. The Western Roman Empire fell in the 430s. That was overrun by the Vandals and the German tribes. But the Byzantine Empire never fell. And then in the 500s under Justinian, it conquered most of the land of the Western Empire. In other words, it conquered a lot of what was lost to the German, the Roman Empire was reconquered by the Byzantines. But that didn't last too long because, like we mentioned before, in the 630s till 700, the Muslims came. The Muslims took everything away from the Byzantines, not everything away, but it took everything from North Africa. It took a large part. It took Asia Minor, not all of Asia Minor, but it took a lot. And Byzantines still had an empire. And that same Byzantine empire was still around until, we're going to see tonight, until 1452. So the first community, as it started getting bigger, was the Jewish community of Bursa. And there were Jews all over this area. But up until now, this Jewish community was under the Greeks. And it was, under the Christians. And they had a very hard time of things because the Christians were they were not nice to the Jews. They really treated the Jews like second class, and they made life rough for the Jews. It wasn't like they weren't free to do any economic enterprise. They were very, very taxed. They were, in terms of their religion, they were not allowed to practice as freely as they could. And it was very hard when the Muslims came. So the Muslims, the Ottoman empires were very, very tolerant of other religions, and they were very far-sighted. You know, they realized what was good for an empire and what was necessary, and they were in that mode of expanding an empire and allowing people the freedom to do things. So the treaty when they took over Bursa was that the Greeks that were there, the Christians that were there, were able to retreat, to leave, to go to Constantinople. Over here, this is, I guess, a more of a modern map. This city called Istanbul is really Constantinople. We're going to see that, So that was the first community, and this is in the early 1300s. The next community was going to be Gallipoli in Europe. In other words, again, this is Europe. I'm sorry, this is Asia, and this is Europe. And there's just like a waterway that just, like, very, very thin waterway. There's a lot of trade, a lot of business things that go through this area. Very strategic in this area in terms of, you know, in terms of if you run the area, then you're in a good position for, you know, trade and economically. And so they took over this area called Gallipoli. Also, more Jews were in that area as well. And then in 1323, you had Orhan, I think it was. And then 1362. And they kept, you know, conquering. He conquered another big Jewish city, and that was called Ankara. That was Ankara. It's in the northeast of Turkey. So they really started here, and they started expanding in all areas. Afterwards, in 1362, 1338, was Murad the First. He also did more conquering. Now, he had a war in Europe in the Kingdom of Serbia. So, if you want to, today's day, the Bosnians, the Muslim Bosnians, and the Christian Serbs, that all came from this war here. This is it. This is where it all started. That war, they did not convert, the Serbs did not convert, but the Bosnians did convert, and all of the back and forths from the Serbs and the Bosnians all came from the war in 1389. Yeah, that was it. So that was captured. It was under the Ottomans as well, and all this ethnic stuff that's coming out today. Kosovo. It's called the Battle of Kosovo. And just, you know, that's been the same for a few hundred years. Okay? The bureaucracy was the Sultan, even though he was the absolute ruler, but he had a few advisors called divans. Then you had the one was about the social and military. Then he had the heads of religious. And he had a religious three divans or three religious chief, I guess the chief rabbi, the chief priest, the chief imam, was the Muslims, the Jews, and the Christians. We may, if I may be able to get to who the chief rabbi was at the time, and just maybe a story or two about that. But that's and this is how the bureaucracy was. Then come Bayazid the first, 1340-89 to 1402. Also, what did he conquered Bulgaria? But he, what happened with Bayazid is he was the Mongols made another run of things. So a person by the name of Timur or Tamerlane, I'm not sure if he was lame.
He was not a Mongol.
He was an Islam, but he was over the Mongol. He had one of the gold.
He was actually fighting some Mongols.
Right, but he
was. He was also from Turkish.
He took over one of the Kahanates of the Mongols. So, but after the Mongol Empire also broke down into different areas, and they had different Kahanates, but the. What this is, I guess, really not for us directly, but the Kahanates, they ended up becoming the religion of who they conquered, the leaders. So in the West, when they conquered, let's say, Persia, or they conquered certainly other areas, let's say Persia, they became Muslims. When they conquered the Russia area, so that Kahanate became the religion of the Russians. So they all became. So there was a Tamerlane had a war with Bayazid the first. He captured him, and then a year later, Bayazid died. So Bayazid died in 1403. For the next 11 years, there was like a fight, a succession. Who was going to be the next Sultan of the Turks? So for 11 years there was no wars. You know, they couldn't advance. You need, I guess, a real strong sultan. And then finally in 1413 to 1421 came Mehmed the first, and he conquered another. This is also going to be one of the major Jewish communities called Smyrna. We may come back to Smyrna because I think anybody know who spent some time in Smyrna? Shabsai Svi. That was one of his Shabsai Svi. So I know he's had a following in Smyrna. I think he may have been living in Smyrna for a while. But this is, Shabsai Svi is not until the 1600s. So we got some time till we get there. But this is, again, they're conquering the entire Asia Minor. And it was conquered by Mehmed. And then in 1421 to 1444, again, we're getting close to where 1492... is Murad II, and he conquered another. He conquered Greece, and along with Greece came Salonika. Salonika had a Jewish community, but Salonika is going to become even bigger. Salonika is going to become one of the biggest Jewish communities around with the exile. That's going to be a popular place where the Jews are going to end up. What's going to happen also with the Jewish communities that are here? So there's going to be three things that are going to happen to all the Jews under the Muslims. And it's mainly going to start a little later than this. But you had what you call the Romanos Jews, and those were the Greek Jews. Those were the Jews that were under there. Originally this area was Greek Orthodox. It was under the Christians. So you had the Jews that were living there before the Muslims came. Then you had Jews that were from the exiles. So now you're going to have Sephardic Jews. So you're going to have the Jews that were living there all the time, and then Sephardic Jews, and they're going to be absorbed. They're going to come in with the. And then the third thing happened is, as the Muslims, as the Ottomans kept conquering countries, so they wanted certain countries to be populated. They kept changing their capital. Like Bursa was the capital first. I'm not sure if it was Ankara. There was a second place that was a capital. And we're going to see the next, when they conquer Constantinople, they're going to make that the capital, and change the name to Istanbul. So what they're going to want to do, they're going to forcibly move Jews from one place to another. And it's going to be, so now, besides having the Jews that were originally there, and besides having the exiles that are coming from Spain, you could have Jews that were either these two in other cities and being forcibly moved to another city. So now you're going to have people, Jews all over, not like nobody's in the right place anymore. It's like, you know, Yosef and Mitzrayim, he just like turned everybody over, moved everybody into a different place. So that's what's going to happen among the Jews here. Now the Muslims, at least in the beginning, the Ottomans are going to be very, what's the right word? They're going to be very easygoing, liberal, so to speak, and he's going to have allow the Jews to have set up as many groups that they want, or you know, as many shuls as they want. So you're going to have a situation where you're going to have in Salonika there could have been like I think there was about 20 or 30 shuls, because you know people came from different cities in Spain, they wanted their own, and you had different Jews coming from, you know, Anusim are coming at different times, and they're going to want their own cities, you know, so they first would come to one of the shuls there, and then they eventually split. But you're going to have in different areas, you're not necessarily going to have in any one city one big shul. You're going to end up having little shuls from different Jews from different backgrounds.
Where is Eretz Yisrael in all this?
Okay, so Eretz Yisrael is not conquered yet. It's not conquered yet. It's going to be conquered soon. It's going to be conquered early 1500s. It's going to be conquered in the early 1500s. Just this is a letter. Now you're talking mid 1400s. So this is a Yitzhak Tsarfati, and he writes to the holy communities of Germany. And you just get a sense from his letter what the Jews in Germany were going through, and what he's right. He is in the Ottoman Empire, and he's writing to his brothers in on the Rhine. He's writing to his brothers in Germany. He says, "You got to be crazy to stay where you are." He says, "My brothers in Germany, under tyrannical laws, compulsory baptisms, banishments, which are daily occurrence. I am told when they flee from one place, yet a harder fate befalls them in another. I hear an insolent people raising its voice in fury against a faithful remnant living among them." He writes, I guess this is translated from, you know, I guess sort of poetic, he writes, "I see its hand uplifted to smite at my brethren. On all sides I learn of anguish, daily exactions levied on merciless oppressors. The clergy and the monks, false priests as they are, rise up against the unhappy people of God and say, 'Let us pursue them even into destruction. Let the name of Israel be no more among them.' They imagine that their faith is in danger because the Jews of Jerusalem might peradventure buy the Church of Sepulchre." Now, what happened is at this time of this letter, which is in the 1400s, a few Jews that were in Israel bought some land on Har Tzion next to the church. I don't even know if it was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I don't even think it's there. I think the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, is it on Har Tzion or is it on Har Zeisim? But Jews bought a plot of land next to a church, and the priests in that church had a cow, and they start writing letters to the Pope. "You got to do something, because the Jews, if they buy land, they're going to take over." So the Pope, because of this, sent out a decree that any Christian ship going to the Holy Land should not take Jews. And if they have Jews, throw them overboard. Don't let them go to the Holy Land. So he's writing this in his letter, like saying, you know, there was a Jew, the Pope just from you Europeans, the Pope just said that the Jew found upon a Christian ship bound for the East shall be flung over in the sea. How evil are the people... How evil are the people of God in Germany treated. Sadly is their strength departed. They're driven hither and thither. They're pursued even to death. The sword of their oppressors hang over their heads. They are flung into flames, swift-flowing rivers and foul swamps. Brothers and teachers, friends, acquaintances, I, Yitzhak Tsarfati, though I spring from French stock, yet I was born in Germany. I sat there at the feet of my esteemed teachers. I proclaimed to you that in Turkey is a land wherein nothing is lacking, and where, if you will, all shall yet be well with you. The way to the Holy Land is open to you. I guess through Turkey, you're able to go to the Holy Land. At this point of the letter, I do not think that they conquered the Holy Land yet. It was probably still under the Seljuk Turks. This is way after the Crusades. The Crusades were all gone. There was no more Crusades in the land, but it was under the Muslims. But you can make it there. That's it. It was just, you know, you keep going. Is it not better for you to live under Muslims than under Christians? Here every man dwell at peace under his own town and fig tree. Here you are allowed to wear the most precious garments. In Christendom, on the contrary, you dare not even venture to clothe your children in red or blue, according to your taste, without exposing them to the insults of being beaten black and blue or kicked red and green. And therefore you are condemned to go about plainly clad in sad colored clothing. Today we do it ourselves. We just wear black and white. So nobody's telling us, you know. All right, whatever. All your days are filled with sorrow, even the Shabbos and the times of Yom Tov, and strangers enjoy your goods, and therefore what profit and wealth of your rich men? They are hoarded, but just to their own sorrow, and in a day it's lost for them forever. You call your riches your own? They belong to them. They bring false accusations against you. They neither respect age or wisdom. And though you gave them a pledge sealed 60-fold, yet they would break it. They continually double punishment upon you with death of torment and the confiscation of goods. They prohibit teaching in your schools. They break in upon you during your hours of prayer. In certain places they can get up and give sermons whenever they want it in the shul. They prohibit teaching in your schools. They forbid you to work or conduct your business on Christian feast days. And now seeing all this, why are you still asleep? Arise! Leave this accursed land forever. This is a letter from Rav Yitzchak Sarfati of Turkey to the Jewish communities in Rhineville Valley. So, yes, you get a sense of what he's trying to tell these Jews. What are you doing there? Come! It's great here, you know? Okay, so that was just there's also a very interesting, this is a tshuva. But this is from Rabbi Irons. Rabbi Irons is he's a Rosh Kollel in Detroit, and he gives history classes also. So what he likes doing is he brings like tshuvas like this, and from the tshuvas you get a sense of what was going on there as well. Incident of a wise, who was a young physician. His name was Yaakov Pasha. So basically what happens is he decided he was going to move to Eretz Yisrael. So on his way to Eretz Yisrael, he stops in Andropolis. I think at that point it was the capital of, that was one of the capitals. As they conquered and the empire shifted, the center of the empire shifted, so they would shift their capital to be centrally located until they conquered, in 1453, they conquered Constantinople, and that became their capital. So he comes to Andropolis, and he was a doctor. And he came to the attention of the king's ministers, Sultan Murad II, who happened to be at the time. He said, no, you're now part of me. He took him part of his royal household. He traveled with the king wherever he went. King Murad's son, Muhammad Mahmud, who became the next sultan, took him, asked his father, can I have him as my personal physician? Sultans had lots of wives. They had, I guess, what you call a harem. They would have the first wife, then they would have, I think, like four sub-wives, and I don't think that include concubines. And who had the wife, the first wife was Chashev, the mother of the first wife was Chashev, the mother of the firstborn son was Chashev, so it depends which wife gave him the firstborn son. So, but it was that's the way it was. They had wives. They had a whole harem. They had, not only did you have the wives, but you had their kids, and then you had the mothers or the parents of. So you could each of these sultans had a nice big royal family. So this Yaakov Pasha was taken to become the personal physician. Now, in the year 1451, this is Mahmud II. He's going to conquer Constantinople. But on his own, this is a and this was a this is a tshuva of the this is a tshuva of the Marshtam. Marshtam was a so he's writing. This is what he's writing. He's going to set up what the question was. So, Muhammad II, as Sultan, wanted to show his affinity, his hakaras hatov, his love for this Yaakov Pasha. So he said that Yaakov Pasha himself and his children never have to pay taxes. That's it; they're exempt from taxes. And he did it on his own. It wasn't like Yaakov Pasha said, you know, maybe you could, like, you know, give me a break on taxes, you know, or tax reform or whatever. But no, it came all from he did it on his own. Anyway, what happens is this is in 1451. By 1453, they go ahead and they conquer Constantinople. And so he freed him from any type of taxes. It leaves for all eternity for him and his posterity, his children. Yaakov Pasha and his family end up moving into Constantinople. As a matter of fact, the king forcibly moves Jews from all over, because since he wanted that to be the capital, he knows he needs Jews as the merchant class. They're very good at business, economics. They know Jews in all over in other countries that they could do business with, and it was very so they moved a lot of Jews there. So the Jews are now they join the Jewish community in Constantinople, and it was at the and they kept of course they were following the dictates of the king that they didn't have to pay taxes. There were a whole bunch of taxes that had to be paid. One was a poll tax, and that was per person. So the other Jewish community didn't care about that, because whether you pay or not doesn't make a difference. Every person has to pay. It was a special tax for times of war. Ottoman Empire most of the time was at war, so you had to pay that. That was a war tax. But then the Jewish community had to pay a tax. So the Jewish community, whoever was in the Jewish community, the leaders of the Jewish community had to figure out, okay, we have 20 families, and they want $200 from us, or everyone has to pay, you know, $10. You know, if it's $1,000, everyone has to pay $100. You know, whatever it was, that's what they. However, Jacob Pasha's family was exempted, so that was okay in the very beginning when he was a small family. But as time went on, the exemptions kept continuing for the family, and now they had a big size family and they were being exempted. So the question was sent from the Jewish community, is that, you know, that was okay for Jacob Pasha, but as the years went on, the family kept bigger, we can't afford, you know, is it fair that the rest of the Jewish community doesn't have to pay the taxes? And basically he ends up saying, he just kept saying it, how it was redone. After Mahmud's dead, his son Bayazid II, he reconfirmed that they don't have to pay taxes, and his son Selim number 1 confirmed it, and Suleiman confirmed it, and Suleiman II confirmed it, and now we are here in the late 1500s. Okay, that was like in 1450. We're talking about 120 years later, the Jewish community, how many more descendants of this family is here, and nobody's paying taxes. So they wanted the Marshtam to say, Paskin, that they had to pay taxes. And he ends up, in my opinion, we're required to observe the king's decrees, and that's it. They don't have to pay taxes. That's how the Marshtam ends off his tshuva. Just say, huh?
That was short.
Yeah.
His response was short.
That's it. His response was short, but he, you know, he pulled it up and showed what it was. It could be there was more to it. He pulled out what the Mahmud II, the conqueror. Okay, so he's the one that's going to conquer Constantinople. Constantinople. So I was reading up on the battle. Just I guess maybe before we just go, what was Constantinople? Constantinople's battle. It was highly fortified. I mean, they really had tremendous defenses around the city. The only thing was, is at the time it was really cut off from the rest of Europe. I mean, the Ottoman rulers didn't try to take the city because it was just too well fortified. So they bypassed it. So it was in its own area, highly fortified inside. When Mehmed II came to become ruler, he was like in his 20s. He was a young kid. He says, "No, I'm taking it. We want Constantinople. We're going to go take it." And they said, "Come on, what do you need it for?" Like, his father actually made a treaty with them, but this one he decided to break it. So he assembled 120,000 troops, and inside there were 12,000 defending troops. And it was they kept sending people in, and they kept losing. You know, and it was just so. His general said, "This is not worth it. You know, what are we doing?" And they almost like gave up on the thing. Except, so Mehmed said, "Okay, let's do just one last main battle. We'll do all everything at the same time. We'll see what we can do." They actually, one of the things they got for this was this big cannon that they had made in Poland. You know, in Poland, they got this big cannon, like, but it took them a long time to shoot it. So they were only able to shoot it like 12 times a day. And say, yeah, you had to keep and whatever it needed to be done, you know, just till you filled it up and, you know, okay. In any case, but that's what they did. So you know how they won? They just kept losing and losing. Somebody left one of the doors open. One of the gates were left open in the in Constantinople, and they just charged in the gates, and there were so many of them that they couldn't kill them all, and that's how Constantinople fell. It was somebody left the gate open, and
on purpose, maybe.
It could be, but the people in there knew that if they lost, they were going to go. That they were going to be killed. It says that they rioted for 3 days and nights. They looted. And then afterwards, Muhammad said, "That's it, enough." And then he took over the whatever was left of the city, rebuilt it for himself, and wanted to, again, move Jews there as well. So that was in 1453. So this is where, remember, I told you that he had, that part of the structure was he had a chief rabbi, a priest, and a chief imam or whatever from all the three major religions. So the first one of the very first chief rabbis was a person by the name of Moshe Kapsali. Moshe Kapsali was a big tzaddik. He would be, besides being a big Talmud Chacham, he was an ascetic. He would, you know, he wouldn't sleep in a bed all week. He was, again, he gave great advice, and he was very, very helpful to the king. It brings down one story. One was, right, as you said, it was one for each of the big communities. The king loved him dearly, placed his seat next to that of the mufti. So instead of Christian being number two, he was number two. He was very humble. And the king was very impressed with his good advice. And he was in charge of all the taxes. And then he was a very advocate for the Jewish people. If I'm not mistaken, I think I have to double check this. But now that I'm thinking about it, there was a... No, I take it back. This not was him, it was somebody else. Okay. Something happened in Italy, and he told the Sultan to make a blockade, but that's somebody else. It's, I think, a Chaim Ramon, and it was a different doctor, different later. But in any case, something that happened with him is that there was a plague, and people were dying. It was a big plague in the Ottoman Empire. So the Sultan, like, you know, didn't know what to do, and he asked his Muslim leader, "What's going on here? Why is there a plague?" "I don't know." He asked the Christian, "I don't know." "Yes, Moshe Kapsali, why is God giving a plague on us?" So he answered back, he says, "I'll tell you why." He says, "God does not like promiscuity. When there's licentiousness, there's a plague." So the king says, "Yeah, let me check into it." And sure enough, he checked into it. and he found that his Janissaries. Now, the Janissaries. Oh, that this is pretty much it. So, if you, this is the these two slides are it. So, the Janissaries was the special force army that was recruited by the Ottomans. Basically, when they conquered a new land, they forcibly took kids, and they made a special army out of them. Two of the requirements was is you can't grow a beard, and you can't get married. You know, and your allegiance is going to be. I think it was like it was like almost like the Secret Service. You were like really answerable to the Sultan. You were, the Sultan took his bodyguards from there, and when there was no war, they doubled as like the policemen, but. This was a very, and they were trained very well. They were treated well, and they were trained well. So at some point, it became a status to become part of the Janissaries. It was a big, status. So, but since they weren't allowed to marry, so when the king, when Mehmed did his investigations, he found a lot of this that was going on. There was a lot of promiscuity that's going on with the army, and he came down very strong and hard against them. It actually says that Moshe Kapsali, he also did an investigation, and he found that if there were any Jewish women that were involved in this, he also severely rebuked them and took care of whatever he had to take care of, and sure enough, the plague stopped, and that, of course, elevated Moshe Kapsali. The Janissaries, just by the way, that was their like main army. I mean, this was a vicious, very, very mobile, very quick, I think it was the first standing army in all of Europe, ever. I think just the fact that you had an army that was like just, I take that back, I don't know about that, but it was one of the largest standing armies in Europe or under the Sultans. And this army, this was eventually the army is going to rebel and try to rebel against the king, revolt, and eventually the sultan is going to tell the people to kill the Janissaries, which they did, and eventually it's going to be totally disbanded. But I think they say this is like the beginning of the Janissaries, not being so up and up with the sultan. They tried to kill Moshe Kapsali, because it was Moshe. They realized it was Moshe Kapsali that got the king to investigate them. And Moshe Kapsali, he escaped with his life. They tried to kill him, and he got away. False witness. Okay, that's one story with Moshe Kapsali. He just then brings another story where there was a somebody came to collect from either Egypt or Eretz Yisrael for poor people. Now at that time, in history of time, the Ottoman Empire was at war with that country that he was collecting for. So Moshe Kapsali felt he couldn't give this guy a letter of recommendation, because if you're giving him a letter of recommendation to collect for people for that country, it could be taken as treason. So Moshe Kapsali did not give him that letter, but he also... I guess he didn't stop him, but he sort of allowed him to give his pitch in the shuls, and he even told one of the rubs, I think, or Eliezer Mizrahi, who will be the next rub, who is the author of the Mizrahi, the on Rashi, a Pirush on Rashi, on Chumash. So he didn't want to let him, and Moshe Kapsali said you could let him. But he felt slighted, this person. He was known as Moshe 24. He was known as Moshe 24. Why 24? Either because he knew the 24 books of the Bible, of Tanakh, or he came from a place in Germany called 24. Anyway, so he there were people that did not like Moshe Kapsali, and they hooked up with him. And they forged documents, and they made a terrible thing. And then Moshe 24 went to another country, went to Italy, where he met up with the Marek. Okay, he met up with the Marek. And he presented him with the documents, and he said, this is what Moshe Kapsali did to me. Now the Marek took this guy at face value, because he was enough of a Talmud Chacham that he believed him, and I guess he didn't hear about Moshe Kapsali, and he wrote a stinging letter. How could you do such a thing? Who is this Moshe Kapsali? And basically he wrote a letter. The letter was sent to Moshe Kapsali, but for 2 years it got lost. 2 years later, the letter finally gets it to Moshe Kapsali. He sees the letter, and Moshe Kapsali calls a meeting of all the Jews, all, you know, the Romanos, the conversos, the natives, all of them. He says, "Look, this is the letter. What do you think?" And they were so upset, and they, you know, started to piece it together of all these the four or five that were that instigators, and how they got this Moshe 24. And basically what they did is they started to look for all these other people. They all had died. They all had died. And then they sent a letter back to the Marek. And the Marek realized that he was duped by this other person. And he cursed the other, this Moshe 24, that he did this. And he wanted to go to Moshe Kapsali himself to ask him for forgiveness. But he himself, the Marek, got sick himself. And he said, he made his son promise, Marek's son promised to go to Moshe Kapsali and ask for forgiveness for me. And that's how that story ends. So Moshe Kapsali was a, okay, and this is how, this is his letter that he took up for him. Okay, and that was the thing. I just want to maybe just end with, okay, that's where the Ottoman Empire is. Again, this is all what's today Turkey. Well, Ben was Turkey. This area is called Asia Minor. And that's where the Black Sea goes into the Aegean Sea. There's only a small little area that gets through. That's how strategic Istanbul or Constantinople was, because it's that's the border of the two continents. And anybody that wants to get through the Black Sea into Russia or into Asia Minor on the north has to go through that area, and also from the south to the north. And that's why it's very, very strategic. This is from the satellite picture. So it would be about over here, and this is where the Golden Horn, I guess. This is supposed to look like a horn. And this is today. This is the river that goes through Istanbul today. Okay, the Janissaries. We spoke about that. And I just wanted to point. I know I pointed this out last time, but I just pointed out again. When the Jews had to leave from Spain, right? So they left from Spain in 1492. All of North Africa was not part of the Ottoman Empire yet. So all that you see in light green was conquered in 1512. A lot of it was conquered because when the Jews got there, first of all, just as a point, in 1497, 1498 was the first printing press was set up in the Ottoman Empire. And the Jews come, within a year, there's a printing press. Gunpowder. That was also a lot of the wartime things were military weapons. The Jews that were in Spain came and taught the Ottomans how to make weapons. Navigations with the astrolabe, Jacob Staff. You know, a lot of all the map making for boats and ships that all came from Jews. That was all from Jews. And when the Jews left Spain and they came to the Ottomans, they brought all that with them, all the technology, all the weaponry, all the business parts, everything that came. And that was Bayazid. It's going to be the one who's going to be the Bayazid II. He's the one that says you're mistaken to call Fernadad smart, for he has made his country poor and enriched my country by sending me the Jews. But I just want to point out, in 1451, 1481, they only have the dark green, which means all this, North Africa, was not under the Ottomans yet. Egypt, Israel, this is all in the early 1500s. That's when they got it. But
they only had mainly Asia Minor and a little bit into Europe. So the Jews, when they left Spain, to get to the Ottomans was very, very hard. The Ottomans did send ships to pick up Jews and take them. But in reality, just only a minority was able in 1492 to be able to get that far. And what you had to do to get there was you had to go through everything. So if you first went to Portugal, that was bad. But, you know, a few places they started here, the different places. Eventually, many of the people, they stayed for a while, and then they eventually made their way out. Yeah.
Two questions. What under what? I mean, who was Eretz-Israel under before the Ottomans?
The Seljuks. If I'm not mistaken, the Seljuks, Muslims, different tribe, different clan. It was just a different. They were Muslims, but not the Ottomans.
Were there Jews living in Yerushalayim?
Yes, there were. It was very, very nothing like. Yes, there were, but it was backwards. It was a lot of taxes, corruption. It wasn't an easy place for them to live. When the Ottomans come and take over, so the Ottomans have a very, very liberal, very, you know, good policy towards the Jews. That's when Israel is going to start to pick up. As a matter of fact, you're right. A lot of the exiles are going to go to Eretz Israel. It's going to be a tremendous infusion of Jews into Jerusalem and Sfat, those two in particular, other places along. Egypt is going to pick up a lot. You know, everybody's going to pick up a lot. I mean, relatively a lot from what they had, you know, what really made it there. So if 300,000 Jews made it there, maybe 20% of 300,000 Jews, at least in the beginning, ended up making it, you know, made it to safety or whatever. I mean, more than half went to Portugal. So, and that's if it was 300,000 Jews. If it was less, then the numbers were less. All right, so maybe we'll stop here. Mitzvah Hashem, I hope next time to talk about Eretz Yisrael, because now there's gonna be a tremendous infusion, and it's gonna be like the who's who. In Jewish history and like Jewish scholarship, you're going to have Kabbalah, you're going to have the Beit Rav, you're going to have the Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Yosef Cairo, and all right. So, Mr. Shem, we'll pick it up next week.
Okay.